Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is data-driven decision-making. Today's guest, Dr. Steve Stoddard, will help us connect how the Army continues to leverage data for decision-making. Dr. Stoddard is the director for the Center for Army Analysis. He is a retired Army officer, but now focuses on the Army's structure, capabilities, capacity, and readiness to execute the National Defense Strategy. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Today, I want to take a bigger aperture than most episodes and talk about how data, modeling, and doctrine work together to drive change and help inform decision making. So, sir, could you start off the conversation just by telling listeners about the Center for Army Analysis?
Yes. So, okay. You used a key term there at the beginning. You said about from the National Defense Strategy, and that's where we anchor everything. But we think of it as, to execute the strategy, all the way through to what are we going to encode in the Army's program objective memorandum? What are we going to invest in? So I've got a field operating agency. We're about 150 people, mix of military and civilians. Maybe half of our civilians are also veterans. And when we start everything that we do, we start with a basis of strategy. And we turn that strategy into some representations of what might occur. So think of a war plan, a theater-level war plan, or a theater-level planning scenario, maybe set currently or maybe set in 5 years or 10 years or what have you. And then what we do is we tear that scenario apart. If you've ever served in like a corps or theater level staff, think of what you would do in the plan shop. Think of executing that full military decision-making process. Two of our divisions are dedicated to wargaming those plans. So they execute the military decision-making process over and over and over again. And they've got some really interesting tools to do that. They've got wargaming tools that are, well, some of them are, we build it once and we use it once. Some of them are much more structured and then we use over and over again. But the key is that they're all grounded in the context of the operation, but most of them are also really driven by data. So think of it as an application of military art, but underpinned by science. And what we frequently get out of that, besides insights about, you know, how well something might work, is, say, if it's a plan or scenario, a concept of the operation. So you built a concept of the operation, now you've wargamed it, and so now you have this idea that you've got a concept that's feasible, acceptable, suitable for the mission. And we turn that over to our modeling division. We have a campaign analysis division. It's our biggest division, and they've got quite a handful of physics-based models. And so think of this team as applying military science, but underpinned by military art, because we've had a chance to put strategists and logisticians and intelligence experts around a table for maybe weeks on end to think through how a plan will unfold. So then we model it, and then we can model it a lot of different times. We've got one particular operation we've modeled more than 50,000 times, so we can examine different variables. Now, the outcome of that, this modeling is really combat-centric, but it gives us the what we call campaign metrics. So things like how much ammunition did we expend? How many casualties did we suffer? How long do we have to keep our main supply routes open? How did all of these things occur over geography and time through the execution of a campaign? We turn that over to our next division, which is focused on the Army's enablers. So they will then look and say, casualties. How were our casualties distributed by type and time and geography so that they can translate, they can apply the doctrinal rules of allocation and say, we need this many forward surgical resuscitation team. I need this much medevac. Helicopter borne, this much ground medical evacuation. I need this much hold capacity. I need this much en route care. I need this many field hospitals all the way through the theater's operating space. And they do that for every single enabling function down to chaplain teams. From there, we say, all right, everything I've talked about now is about one theater conflict. Then I bring it to my last division, our force strategy division. And what they will do, they're not my last division, they're the last in this process. What they will do is think of this theater war fight in the context of the Army executing its unit life cycles or readiness cycles over time. So they will model 8 or 10 or 13 years of the Army in motion. Regular Army, National Guard, Army Reserve, all units going through modernization cycle phases, training phases, going on exercises, humanitarian relief missions, small contingencies, what have you, so that when the major theater war fight goes, the thing that really tests our structure and capability, well, we can't magic move into that conflict. Some units will not be ready to go. Some units will have all of their equipment torn apart. Some units will be off on the wrong side of the planet. Some units, well, we'll have stood them down and you don't get to use them at all. So that helps us inform what we should have and helps us test alternatives for what we'll actually resource, because of course we never have enough to complete that whole mission. So we have to do some risk trades. My other analysis division is maybe the most data centric. So these are my data science experts. We will put them in and out of these various teams all along that path. They're also the team that is embedded in current ops. Wherever there's a current operation that the Army's heavily involved in, we'll have an analyst deployed to that. We've had as many as 8 at a time embedded in the theater right now. Our most intensive effort in that lane is with the conflict in Ukraine. So one of my analysts is embedded in the SAGU Security Assistance Group Ukraine headquarters.
Okay, so if I understand the process right, you take a plan.
Yes.
Do MDMP on that.
Yes.
Then that goes to a simulation.
Yeah. So we'll simulate effectively in two ways. First with wargaming, and then with physics-based modeling. The wargaming helps us get the human decision-making, the application of the military art, the interpretation of doctrine correct. And then that way we don't put garbage into the model. Once upon a time, we didn't have all that wargaming, and some of our sister organizations may not emphasize it the way we do, but we used to get things out of our model and we'll say, why did this happen? And it doesn't make sense. And we would find that, some modeler along the way, well, there's a million implicit little assumptions that you make when you're putting something into a model. The term I use is sometimes if you put garbage in, I'm afraid you'll get gospel out. People will believe there's results of those models, but they were garbage in the first place. By doing all of the wargaming, we can be pretty confident that the things that we put into the models in the first place make operational sense. I should stress that when we do this, especially the wargaming, that we do it always in a joint context and whenever we're allowed to do it in a combined context. Because we're at the theater level, our partnerships with the sister services are really important. So sometimes we will band together to wargame a scenario, and then we can go our separate ways to do modeling of the specific capabilities that we're trying to build out in our services. I spent this week with my counterpart from the United Kingdom to make sure that the scenarios that we're building together to test how we will fight alongside the United Kingdom makes sense, because they're just published a new warfighting concept, as did we. How do those things complement each other? And we'll do the same thing. We have done the same thing with certainly the other 5i allies.
Can we talk more about wargaming? And just because I think about wargaming through, military decision-making process, but it was very rushed. It was, or very much so, glossed over. I am assuming that when you're talking wargaming, you're spending a lot of time and effort in that. So can you kind of maybe talk what you're doing at your level?
I'll differentiate a little bit between, say, a strategic war game and an operational war game. I'll start with the operational level war game, because that's the one that feeds the models most directly and I think is closer to what you're asking me about. So we have a theater level wargaming model that's been built over years. It started by a Sam's planner in one of our divisions, 1st CAB division, and we built it out and built it out and built it out. So it's really underpinned by data. When the team is going to wargame a plan, we go through a 2 to 3 month buildup of all the data that's going to be involved in that. Let's make sure that we have the right representation of all of the combat forces for us, our sister services, and our allies. let's get the National Ground Intelligence Center to give us the latest and greatest on the orders of battle for the threats. Let's take the performance data of all the systems that we think that will play, and then we built out that will play so that we can then put that into our adjudication method. We have a computer-based adjudication so that when the team goes through the turns, and I should describe a turn just briefly. A turn might be 3 to 5 combat days, and they'll do typically 2 turns a day. So think of that, what's going on in a turn. The first thing we're going to do is say, all right, well, what's the weather like? And how does the ISR work? What's your ISR plan? And what do you see? So we'll take it sort of a logical, largest down to most detailed. So after the ISR, it's the deep fire strikes. And then we'll go through, what the Air Force is doing. And then we'll go through the naval combat. And then we'll go through the ground combat. And then at the end, we'll resupply. And we'll sort of do all that, adjudicate 3 days. All of that adjudication is done very transparently. So, you know, picture paper map board on the ground, icons moving along, a video representation of that so people can see it, but also a video representation of the strength of every unit and what happens at every bit of conflict so you can understand the adjudication. Huh, this unit fought that unit. I would have thought that unit did better. Why did that happen? Was it something I can see what happened here. Maybe we need to adjust the data. Or no, you didn't understand the capability there. Or, you know what? That's a chance. Sometimes we have to bring in uncertainty, and it didn't go. So not everything is a certainty. And we played that out. So that's the theater level. And then I should also give you a characterization of who's playing. When we're doing a defense planning scenario game like this, we'll have experts in the capabilities that are being played. We have a very expert red team from within the Army. Usually the TRADOC G2 helps us out. The Army is standing up a new Army red team that's going to take over a good chunk of that role. And they're great. And they give us really good, consistent, not just representation of the threat's capabilities, but how they will operate those capabilities. And so picture, 40 or 80 people playing through this. We've done bigger, and then we've probably got 250 people. We've got the component commanders themselves. So the last time we did that, General Flynn was our Army component commander. Admiral Paparo was there as the PAC fleet commander. And then we briefed out at the end, Admiral Aquilino as the combatant commander. And the people that are bringing their various type, the fires, who's going to be the commander of the fire element? Who's the theater sustainment commander, right? Bringing all of these players together to play out their roles. So that's a campaign war game. A strategic war game, those vary pretty dramatically because we're usually looking at some type of thing around or setting the battle. This spring, for example, in a different version of Unified Pacific, we played out the 4 years or so that from now till a potential crisis. So there the time steps are like 6 months long. And what we're exercising is every country's plans to change the conditions in the theater, but each of these things have a political, diplomatic, economic type of plus or minus. And we found things like maybe some of the things that we wanted to do, maybe we're better off having the Australians do it. Or maybe we shouldn't do it because it's contrary to what our allies in Australia are trying to accomplish. Or maybe we find things like, oh, you're talking about establishing a logistics base here, but we're better off someplace else entirely because of potential challenges with access. And so you play these out. And meanwhile, you've got someone playing the role of every country acting in its own best interest with respect to that other country. So we have people from Department of the State and various desk officers who are really experts in that. And so what we're really trying to understand, or one of the things we're trying to understand, is where the potential areas where this could lead to crisis. One of the challenges with all of our plans and all of our scenarios is that they all have to have you have to contrive a road to war. And the problem with that road to war is that it is contrived to get you into war while everyone's actually trying to not go to war, but try to change the conditions to be more favorable to themselves, or to deny some sort of adversary action short of war. So this construct allows us to identify conditions under which a crisis might arise so that then when we test scenarios or plans, we're perhaps grounded in a more realistic set of circumstances from the start.
I'd like to shift our conversation to total Army analysis, because I know that you have a role in that process, and doctrine also has a role, because doctrine really is foundational or fundamental to the process. So I'm curious about your role in TAA and how you drive senior leader decision-making. But before I throw that conversation over to you, I'll jog the memory of our listeners. So total Army analysis, and this is the CGSC definition, is the key Army force structure, requirements, and resourcing determination process. TAA determines the best mix of affordable organizational solutions for future needs. Okay, so sorry for getting long-winded there. Dr. Stafford, I'll throw it back over to you. So could you talk about your work in TAA and that link with doctrine?
Yeah, great, thanks. What I try to do is I try to replicate the most current doctrine in the process that I talked about before. So when I'm running a war game, or I'm running the modeling, or running the application of the enablers, I'll bring experts in to make sure we're representing the doctrine. For example, we bring in people from the Medical Center of Excellence, and we will lay down on a map how things are, and then we'll try to see how well that squares or doesn't square with the doctrinal application. The big challenges we've had in the last few years is because of the significant differences between the European Theater of Operations and the Indo-Pacific Theater of Operations. Sometimes we've laid out scenarios in the Indo-Pacific, and we've said, and it's really tough to square what we see in the doctrine with how do we stretch the doctrine? So how do we bring in experts in there? And do we need, and then that the CAC team is always at our war games so that they can then say, here's where we need to go back and potentially square that with doctrine. The other thing that the other doctrinal application that's really strong in TAA is this thing called the rules of allocation, which your listeners may or may not be familiar with. For every kind of enabler force, there is a doctrinal rule of allocation that says, hey, if I'm going to have armor brigade combat team, I must have military police company or something like that, right? They're existence role based, but they're also workload based. And much of that workload basis and existence basis has evolved perhaps from what we experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan and may not be appropriate for large scale combat operations. And so we unveil those sort of things in our war games and in our modeling that help provide a feedback loop to say, here's where we might need a change. Further, with the differences between contiguous ground operations that you might have in Europe or CENTCOM versus the Indo-Pacific, you might see a different role for Army formations in terms of who's supporting who. We may have sustainment formations and air missile defense formations as the center of our operations in the Indo-Pacific, and we may be using, for example, infantry as security for that. So we may have a reverse rule of allocation, if you will. I don't know. These are things we're examining and experimenting with. One of the discussions we've had is historically we've done these processes, the force design, force development, and then the TAA in sequence. And that's caused us to limit ourselves. For example, if we publish doctrine and turn that into a force design update that says this formation looks exactly like this. Well, historically, what we would do in TAA is we would take that approved force design update and what we would say, this is how many we have to have. But maybe the answer was, we should go back and consider making that formation smaller and have more of them, or larger and have fewer of them. We haven't historically included the process of developing doctrine and turning the doctrine into force design updates as part of the end decision. By the time things get to the chief and secretary, well, someone else would have decided on the force design update, and all they're doing is a quantification decision. Really, maybe the decision space should be more all-encompassing. So that's what we're trying to do in evolving the TAA process right now in partnership across FCC and CAC and the Army G3 in particular.
So you're kind of saying that we get stuck down a path, and then, but we know so many things are changing in the Army. And then by the time it gets through your models, it's like, oh no.
Well, it's not. I think it's less about how we're not keeping with changes. I think it's more about that there's a broader set of decision options, right? So when people make the force design updates, we use the term resource informed, but they're not really resource constrained. So and I've worked in Center of Excellence before, and I know the sort of, man, if we had this, we'd be better. We were always making your formations better, and that grows them. But you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily involved in the part of the process that says, okay, you grew it, but now you get fewer. Because there's a total end strength. We got to fit this all inside of it's a giant, what we call knapsack problem. It can only fit so much, right? And the balance is, and how you might break that balance is what we're trying to figure out. We need to include more of that into the final decision simultaneously. Here's a current one. We've had 15 medevac helicopters in every medevac company for almost 20 years now. So now we've got questions. We used to have 12 helicopters in each medevac company when we were organized around large-scale combat operations before. We went to 15 because of the area or zone coverage that we had to have in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We've still got 15 now. We've adapted our doctrine and our force design updates with the current combat aviation brigades for large-scale combat operations, but we still have 15 ships. Are we better off having 12 ships per company and having potentially more medevac companies that would allow us to build depth through direct support, general support, that sort of thing? I don't know. But that's the sort of thing that we haven't been testing in TAA, but we're trying to expand. What we've always done is said, that's a question for the Aviation Center of Excellence. Their job is to come up with the force design update. They will look at that specific mission lane, probably inside of a division's battle space, maybe a corps' battle space, and come up with an answer. And that force design update would be approved by the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. And then our job in TAA would be then to say, they're all 15 ships. How many do we need? But when you start thinking about the how many do we need for the whole national defense strategy, you might have come up with a different answer.
Okay, that's interesting. But what you're saying gives me more confidence that there's more inputs to better outputs.
That's the idea. It is a lot, though. There's something like 500 or 700, I lose track, how many different types of deployable formations we have. And we're trying to do that for everyone. So it really requires the expertise in those centers of excellence and in the G3, those force managers, those organizational integrators, who are the real experts within theirs, who can then take the output of our data and turn some of that into decisions.
So we talked the wargaming. I want to kind of talk about the modeling piece. So I'll throw in some doctrine here. ADP 1-01 is our doctrine primer. And we say that doctrine is grounded in a specific view of war and warfare. The doctrine says that our vision of war is accounted for in three elements. That it's inherently chaotic, it's a human endeavor, and it takes place among populations. So all of these elements produce unintended effects on operations. So I really want to highlight that unintended effects. So when you're building your models, how do you account for that uncertainty?
Well, first of all, it's tough. I think we try to do it in different ways for the wargaming tools versus in the physics-based models. In the wargaming tools, our key, what we're doing when we're wargaming is we're very focused on the human decision-making. So we try to capture the uncertainty at each turn, if you will, through distributions of potential outcomes. So, and not that we always know the distributions, we really don't, but we have dice rolls. So things happen. There are a lot of things that will happen in the execution of a game that will be a surprise to the commander of either the red or the blue side. So they have to sort of work through those challenges. Well, what we worry about there analytically is, well, we're probably only going to get a small number of replications of that war game. So we're not really going to get a true understanding of the uncertainty in there. And that's one worry. And the second worry is, are we playing an outlier? You never want to play an extreme case, right? If all of our dice rolls come up snake eyes, and we played, you know, the hardest possible way or the easiest possible way it could go,
yeah,
that doesn't help anybody. So we have to maybe keep a thumb on the scale a little bit to make sure that, you know, the surprises go both ways. But again, we don't really know how real that potential outcome is. But it's a base. And we have a sense of the validity of the concept of the operation from a military art and doctrinal application perspective. That's why we then go to modeling, where we can do thousands of runs. And so what our models allow us to do is set it up in a design of experiments mode, if you will. Let's say we have to do some sort of replication of the threats, or we have to make an assumption about the threat's readiness and what that means for their overall effectiveness. Are they 100% effective? Are they 20% effective? I don't know. There's somewhere in between. We'll play a range of that, and we'll do that against all of the other variables. So we can, again, we create thousands of runs, and that gives us a sense of how things could go. I hesitate to use the word constant confidence interval, because that implies that I actually understand the distributions in there, that 20% to 100%. I don't really know, but if the intelligence estimate tells me 70%, I'm going to put a band on that, and we're going to work for that. So it is again tough. You asked, the first word I used up front was that's tough. Another thing that we do, though, is that we will frequently, I mentioned our sister services before. We've a great relationship with it. We have with them. We will frequently find ourselves modeling the same plans and scenarios because we're testing our own things, right? Well, we'll get together all of the time and say, what result did you get? And then where we look for where we're consistent and where we're not consistent. And where we're not consistent, that's where we'll really dig in and say, okay, why did that happen? Oh, we maybe misunderstood some capability in the Air Force, or maybe there's an uncertainty there that, oh, you assumed it would come this way, we assumed it would go this way. Let's now add that uncertainty to both of our work so we can kind of have a come to grips with what to do about that. I guess the other thing I would say with this too is, any wargame or modeled output, we shy away from calling them very predictive. Anyone that says, oh, this war is going to last 15 days. Well, it's definitely not going to last 15 days. That would be weird if we were right. There's so many variables and so much uncertainty that I mentioned earlier, we use a base case. So we have the base case, and now we run something else. And now we're able to accomplish the mission in 10 days instead of 15. Well, that's a lot better. So, but it cost us another 50,000 rounds of 155 howitzer, or it brought the casualties up, or whatever. So what we're trying to do is offer a comparison between multiple decision options. That's the real power of these tools, is that they help us understand what changes might make the most positive differences for us, okay, as opposed to being predictive. I'll give you an example. Before the conflict in Ukraine launched, we were asked to model that before it happened.
So like when Russia was forming on the border?
Yep. Okay. Russians forming on the border. Everybody's worried. Joint staff asks us, how long is this thing going to go? How long before Kiev falls? So we wargamed it and we said, you know, we don't have great predictive power, but 11 to 15 days is what we thought. Well, everybody laughed at us and said, it's not going to take that long. Right? We were the most optimistic, and we were, of course, wildly wrong. because we were way off on our estimates of both sides will fight, which we actually parameterize, both sides' ability to sustain themselves, and the effectiveness of the Russians' ability to create an integrated plan. Works great on paper. That their plan worked great on paper. Really hard to actually coordinate live. Now, because we've now got 2.5 years of data, our models are pretty predictive for things that happen in that theater, but they're pretty predictive for that theater. If I now try to take what I've learned in the data that's coming off that battlefield and hypothesize that for a, you know, a U.S. force versus some adversary, well, we wouldn't even apply the same capabilities the same way the Ukrainians do, right? We don't have the same doctrine. We don't train our people quite the same way. So it'll unfold somewhat differently. So we have to make extrapolations for that.
This an interesting thing to me, you know, to me hearing about Ukraine, Russia observations that I think sometimes it's not, we're not looking at it. Like they fight differently. They have different capabilities.
Yeah.
It's not a lesson learned. It's an we have to take it as an observation and then apply our doctrine, our capabilities to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the chief of staff of the Army, one of his focus areas is continuous transformation. So I'm curious how you, or even if you can, quickly adapt those models to account for new things that we're seeing on today's battlefields. I know you talked about, you know, modeling already the Ukraine-Russia war. But, you know, essentially part of this, I think, is there's new concepts coming out, new observations coming out, and they haven't been validated by doctrine. So how do you run your process to achieve continuous transformation?
Yes. Okay, good. We actually can, and I feel pretty good about the way we do that. And I'll give you two things for your reading list that might be interesting.
Okay.
You know, I love that we always write things down and never actually read them. But I did read two books. I've read like four in my life, but these are two of them. One is there's a book called Montgomery Scientists, and it is the chronicle of some British operations researchers in Operations Overlord who are following Montgomery's frontline advance and measuring everything, right? So they were doing battle damage assessment. They were measuring craters. They translated that almost immediately into what actually had the effect in the operation. And Montgomery was then changed his TTPs and changed his formations accordingly on the fly. We're trying to do some of that right now with the battle, with the data that's coming off Ukraine, with all the certainly with consideration of the challenges that you just discussed. The other book is a book called How to Measure Anything by a guy named Doug Hubbard. And it's this idea that just because you don't know exactly what something is, there are powerful ways to estimate things, and then to consider where the uncertainty lies in your estimation. Okay, so with those two kind of ideas as foundation, whenever there's something new that must be considered, even if it's not even close to being fielded yet, there are four questions we ask. First, what is the battlefield effect of that capability? Does it help us see farther? Does it help us see more clearly where we look? Does it put more range on our weapon systems? Does it allow us to last longer? What does this do? First. Second is, what's the probability that it's going to work? You call for an effect, that doesn't mean it's going to work the way you said. Artillery rounds all have circular errors probable. Anything that you try to see with any ISR capability, there's a probability of detect associated with that ISR capability. How long is it going to, third is how long is it going to last? What's the duration of the effect that you'll have? So if you've got, for example, an electronic warfare jammer out there, how long can you keep that on before you have to turn it off? And then the fourth is what's the resource constraint associated with that? So is it some capability that you can use once in the whole battle? Or is it something you can use once a day or once an hour? Or what, or you can use till you've run, you've got a magazine depth? What's that? If I know those or have a sense of those four things, then I can replicate that. What we will typically do, like if it's, say, a special access program or something that our team, most of our team can't even know what it is, we'll get one of our team members read on to that program. And that person's job will be then to meet with the experts, ascertain that business of what's the effect, the probability, the duration, and the resource constraint. And then they will give the effect to the commander, or we'll put the effect in the model, and we'll put those probabilities and durations and constraints on it and play the effect without even knowing what the actual capability is. So that's what we do. It doesn't take very long to do that. You just have to have the right people with the right, with the best possible knowledge about that capability. And then if it's a war game, we can have it in the war game shoot the day after we have the discussion. We can have it in the model, depending upon what it is. If it's, you know, if it's a straightforward thing like, you know, range to our solar system or improvement in an ISR capability, we can have that in the next day as well. So some of these things we can turn really rapidly.
Okay. So, you know, I think if one thing that's a lot in the news a lot is the UASs. So what you're saying is you can see what they're doing or understand the capabilities and what they're doing on the battlefield, and then very quickly put that into your model or warrior meter models.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
One of our challenges there is so many of these things are felt at a tactical level, and I'm working at a theater level. So there's a level of aggregation there that's very challenging. So we have other partners around the Army that will focus on very tactical things. So not Center for Army Analysis, but folks within Futures Command, like the Research and Analysis Center or the DEVCOM Analysis Center, that do much the same things that we do, but at a tactical or even system level. And then what we'll do, typically try to do is partner with them to figure out how to aggregate these things so that they're at a theater level fidelity, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So my last question is, I would like to bring this down to the tactical level. I know you just mentioned that you're at the theater level, but what advice would you give leaders at the tactical level and tactical units that are trying to leverage data for decisions? And, you know, especially like, what are the right questions to ask?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think about this a lot because the principal problem that I see sometimes is people will get a bunch of data and they don't really understand it, and they'll try to make decisions off it. And so if I had one bit of advice, it's to really, truly understand the data that you're trying to use, because then whatever you get out of the model will either appropriately make sense or not. I'll tell you a story that goes with this from Iraq. I was the core operations research analyst when General Odierno was the Third Corps commander in Iraq. And so we had, a weekly update, all the data in the world to our multinational force Iraq commander, First General Casey, and then General Petraeus. And when I first got there, I spent hours on the ops floor where all of the reporting was coming in. So I could see how everything was being tracked. You had these soldiers whose job it was to take every report, make sure that it made sense, you know. This latitude longitude says it occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. That's wrong. Get everything, okay. Getting all the data right to begin with. And so I had a really good sense of all the coalition reporting. But we're also getting all the Iraqis reporting. And some of the things that would come in didn't make a ton of sense to me. So I went over to spend some time with the Iraqis. I went to their ops center and watched how their data came in. And what first thing that jumped out at me is there's only one computer in the room. All of the other report, all the people taking reports were doing so by phone. So every person in the room had about four or six phones around them, all of them off the hook, all on speaker, all yelling. So there's this room full of people and all this yelling. And every person taking reports was scribbling furiously on sheets of paper. And then when a sheet of paper was filled, they would take it to the end of the room and put it on the desk where the computer was. And And they explained it to me that the guy at the computer, he would then put all this stuff in. So things that are coming, that are being clear to me are that, well, they're not sending grid locations like you would get in a computer report of where something happened. They would get a colloquial name for a place. So a neighborhood. Where did this happen? It happened in this neighborhood. So it seemed like everything that happened in the neighborhood occurred at the same point.
Oh, okay.
They would round to the nearest hour. Seemed like everything happened in that neighborhood at that point at that hour, right? There was no dispersion. They would round, they would make rough estimates of casualties or damaged vehicles or whatever. So you had these round, all these round numbers. So you might get duplicate reports, but you wouldn't know they were duplicate reports because they weren't the same as the other report. Further, when I looked at down at the table where the computer was, there was nobody sitting at it. I said, well, there's quite a stack of papers here. So like this giant, is that all from today? And they said, no, no, that's been about 5 days or a week's worth of stuff. The guy who runs the computer, he's been out sick. Oh, okay, whatever. Well, I go back to the I go back to our op center. We the next day or 2 days later, we have our weekly briefing to General Casey, and I give my very data intensive brief, and then with just coalition reporting, and then the guy who briefed after me, who always insisted on using Iraqi reporting, was briefing ethno-sectarian violence, and it was low number, low number, low number, low number. Today, huge high number. And he says, well, General Casey says, and the guy's kind of asleep. He's been given the same report forever, right? So it's just routine business to him. But General Casey latches onto this. What happened on that day? What happened yesterday? And the guy kind of spazzes, and he doesn't know. So it is the worst thing you can think. He hypothesizes. And he guesses to General Casey that, well, sir, they were doing all along they've been doing small numbers of large attacks, but they changed tactics to do a whole bunch of small attacks. He made that up, right? He was guessing, and he spazzed, didn't expect a question from the 4-star. And General Casey starts directing traffic. He says, all right, we need to look into this. I'm on, you know, we meet this potentially shift our operation. This is real. We got to get after it. All of this going on. And all I can think of is, I bet the guy at the computer desk just came back from being sick. And that's what it was. So we spent the next few hours unscrewing the communication to the boss. I didn't know. But because I'd been to the op center, I knew how they made their data. So that's the key. To me, if at a tactical level, don't blindly trust data, have somebody involved with the data collection process well enough that you really understand it.
Yeah, that's a great story. anything else that you want to share with our listeners, sir?
Yeah, I'm going to go back a little bit, if I could, into the wargaming. Because one of the changes that I've observed over these last few years, because again, we didn't used to have a wargaming division or dedicated capability. We would wargame implicitly as part of a process. But there's been a tremendous change in how our senior leaders actively participate in wargames so that they can have a personal level of understanding of the potential impacts of the decisions. I've got a story that kind of goes with that. About 8 or 10 years ago, our Army was not designed around near-peer adversaries, not at all, right? Mm-hmm. And we tell ourselves that it was largely Iraq and Afghanistan, and some of it was, but really our high-end threat was a potential conflict on the Korean Peninsula. That was it. Well, many of us around the Army, some leaders, many analysts, had started running games and scenarios, and we started to see where the Army needed to make some changes, but a couple of the Army's key leaders just weren't buying it. I remember taking a set of model results to one of the leaders who said, I don't trust your models. You don't know what I know. American soldier gets toe-to-toe with that adversary. He's going to kick his butt. And I'm trying to say, sure, I don't disagree with that. However, I don't think the American soldier is going to get toe-to-toe with that adversary because our artillery is outranged. We're outgunned. We don't have the bridge crossing capacity. We're in bad shape. Okay. Dismissed. Fine. Well, one of the Army's leaders directed us to hold a war game where the generals would come play their roles. So we created a Europe scenario. We brought General Hodges over from U.S. Army Europe. He played the Theater Army Commander played the JFLIC Commander. Our Corps commanders were, we took the 3rd Corps Commander, and the other Corps Commander was played by General Rainey, who you know who General Rainey is, right? Mm-hmm. So he's playing a Corps Commander. Our Division Commanders were named Flynn, and Cavoli, and Wesley, and a bunch of others. And they were mad. They were mad that we would put them in the scenario with an army that's equipped to lose. We were postured and equipped, and we knew they this is a BS scenario. Why are you making us do this? Sir, play it out. Gentlemen, play it out. And they played, and they were, of course, losing badly. And finally, they said, one of them, General Gonsalves, who was the 4th ID commander, says, we're playing this game so that we're the ones to go tell the chief and the secretary that we got to change. And so they did. The next week happened to be the senior leader readiness forum. We tied into the game because of that. Okay. They were all in town. And the next, there's 24 generals playing, and all 24, each in turn, stood up the next week, explained to the chief and secretary what they saw and what needed to change. They didn't mention my organization. They didn't mention the tool we used, because none of that mattered, right? All that mattered was what they observed. And that experience for those senior leaders has continued. That's the reason we've done 7 Unified Pacific War games, because General Flynn was one of the players in that game. And he, and every one of these games, he drags generals and admirals and senior executives from all around the planet to come watch those games or to participate in some way or to, observe for a few hours and then go back and say, what are the ramifications of what we've just observed? So that everything that comes out of it, he could say, all right, that's maybe something we need to change in the plan. I got to take that to the theater commander. Or it's something that we need to consider changing in our Army's capabilities. I need to take that to the chief and secretary. So that involvement of leaders, and certainly our secretary, she was at one of the Futures Commands games this week, and she's been to our Unified Pacific game. Our undersecretary's been to our games. The chief, the vice, they've been to these games. All of our Army leaders now think of these games as events that they need to then go to and look at so they get a sense of it. And then from there, we can model thousands of combinations and really test those alternatives. So I think it's been a springboard to getting our Army's leaders more analytically informed and more data-driven, even though the war games themselves are frankly much more applications of military art underpinned by the science.
I appreciate your time, sir.
I appreciate yours as well, Lisa. Thanks. This is very enjoyable. Thanks, Lisa.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.